Ahoj, kdo má si, ní přišli mapa, takže řekl, ní tak nemá, ní nikdy, ní Luka, Jacobs, ní nekomus, ale Jacobs. Na kápu sápová, kdo má si, níši. I give you greetings this morning, and I introduce myself as Bear, or Jim Bear Jacobs, you can just call me Jim Bear. I also introduce myself as a member of the Turtle Clan of the Mohican Nation. In addition, I introduce myself as the grandson of Howard Jacobs and Greta Jacobs. And with extreme gratitude expressed in my heart, I extend my greeting to you this morning. I have a unique challenge here in that my preaching style I don't know that I'm that great of a pastor in terms of preaching style. I'm not very shepherdly. My preaching style along the spectrum of pastoral to prophetic would fall probably beyond prophetic sometimes. Usually, I am preaching to churches that I wholeheartedly want, need, and expect to move forward into social action and do something. It is very rare that I speak to a congregation in which I am fully confident that most, if not all of you, are already moving into social action and being agents of justice. So nonetheless, perhaps if this message today doesn't hit home with you, bring it to your neighbors. God knows they need to move forward, right? The text I'm going to preach from today is out of Exodus chapter 2. Starting in verse 11. One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now Moses has this incredibly interesting backstory. In one of the first recorded acts of family separation, Pharaoh issues a decree that all firstborn Hebrew children were to be killed. And Moses' mother has this newborn infant. And like any mother who so desperately wants her child to be safe and protected, rather than turning him over to the authorities, she makes a basket, hides him in the basket, and floats him down the river. Moses is discovered by the daughter of the Pharaoh, a princess. How fortuitous. Moses is discovered by a princess. She pulls him up out of the water, draws him out of the water, and begins to fall in love with this little child. All the maternal instincts begin to awaken. And she decides that she is going to raise this child as her own. Now, Moses' older sister was an incredibly smart young woman because she followed that basket from the point it was put into the river to the point it was discovered. And she came up to this princess and says to her, "Hey, I know someone who can nurse this baby for you, who can nourish this child until such a time that he can be weaned and live with you in the palace." The princess agrees that this is a great idea, and in this beautiful twist of fate, Moses actually spends the first couple of years of his life being raised under Pharaoh's protection by his own mother. It's a beautiful story. But we know that at such a time that Moses was old enough to no longer need the nursing of his mother, he was raised in Pharaoh's palace as one of Pharaoh's children. It's a beautiful story. But then we get to our text today, where Moses, presumably out observing the slaves, not a slave himself, but out observing the slaves, sees an injustice being carried out. And something awakens in Moses, and he slays the oppressor. He tries to hide his actions, and when it is apparent that his actions are well known, Moses pleads to make it. This is where I confess to you that I am not a Western linear storyteller. I speak in circles. So we're going to let this rest and come back to it. Most people who are considered activists can't really point to a moment in their life when they say, "This is when I became an activist." Generally, it's a slow awakening over time, and before you know it, people start calling you activists, and you don't really know how that happened. That is not my story. My activism has a birth narrative. It has a starting point. It happened around this time of year, actually specifically last week, 26 years ago. See, last week was Indigenous Peoples Day. Prior to 3 years ago, 2 years ago, it was known as Columbus Day. In most of the country, it still is known as Columbus Day. And in 1992, I was a sophomore in high school, and it was Columbus Day, or Columbus Day was approaching, I should say. As a sophomore in high school, I was watching events unfold because at various points around our country, there were replica Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria's docked off the shores of our coast so that period-dressed Italian men could make victorious landfall on the shores of our country, replicating Columbus's coming to shore. They were docked down off Hispaniola. There was another set docked somewhere along the American Southeast. There was even a set trio of replica ships docked somewhere off the coast of Los Angeles. Why Los Angeles? You know,
it's mythology.
It's mythology. It doesn't matter. As a young Native man, I was watching as many of my elder relatives and friends who were much more knowledgeable than me get very upset at this. And I wasn't quite certain why they were all upset. I mean, I knew that Columbus never actually set foot in the Americas. I knew that he was lost at sea. Happened to land on a Caribbean island.
That's right.
I did not know the extent of the genocidal practices that he enacted. I was ignorant of that fact. Still, nonetheless, not yet having all of the facts, still something didn't sit right with me. And here, the entire world was gearing up to celebrate the 500th anniversary of America's discovery. And it didn't sit right with me. So, I went into my closet, and I found the most Indian t-shirt I could find. It was one of these t-shirts you find in like a South Dakota truck stop. It was just a white t-shirt, and it had a beautiful, you know, kind of panorama of the Black Hills and some ethereal sort of ghostly chief in a headdress overlooking the Black Hills, right? Like total South Dakota truck stop, but it was the closest thing to an Indian shirt I had. And I put it on. And then I went and I found the closest thing to eagle feathers I could find. They were seagull feathers that are dipped in black paint, so they looked like eagle feathers. It was all I had. I tied those feathers in my hair. I had hair back then. I tied them in my hair. And in a bold black Sharpie marker, I made a sign that said, "I was not discovered," and I taped it to the back of my South Dakota truck stop t-shirt. And I went to school and wore it all day long. And it generated a whole lot of conversation. School newspaper took note, did an interview with me, my first entrance into media coverage. And on that day, I became an activist. Every Columbus Day since then, I have made my visible, sometimes silent, sometimes very vocal stance against this day. I now have real Native regalia. I have real eagle feathers. I got no hair to tie them, but I've got feathers. But I put them on. Because as a sophomore in high school, something awakened in me. I was birthed into activism. Moses, on that day, observing the slaves, something was birthed in me. Now, scholars debate whether or not Moses at this point in his life even realized that he was Hebrew. He may not have known. There are other textual clues elsewhere in the Old Testament that indicate that perhaps Moses was not circumcised as a young boy and therefore did not bear the physical mark of being Hebrew. So he may not have known that he was Hebrew at this point. But he sees an injustice taking place. And the way this plays out in my imagination, why would Moses, who has every benefit of the palace, every privilege that comes with royal blood, why would he look upon the treatment of this nobody, this slave, and take action? Well, it would have been uncommon for Moses to spend time out amongst the slaves. And I think that slowly something started to happen to Moses. Now we know, through a terrible and long history, that wherever slavery takes place, there is a soundtrack to their work. There are old, deeply embedded cultural, historical songs that are sung. And Moses, spending those first 2 years of his life, perhaps longer, at the breast of his mother, his Hebrew mother, would have heard repeated over and over and over those old songs. And probably For a time, growing up under the influence of Pharaoh, his physical mind, his physical brain, no longer retained those memories. But there is a thing known as spiritual memory. And as he spent time among the slaves, I believe his spirit was remembering those songs sung by his mother, sung by his grandmother. And he was moved to compassion. He was moved to action. But Moses' work is not done there. In one single act, Moses purges himself from the palace. It is a singular act to purge ourselves from the palace. But Moses fled. He went to Midian. He spent time amongst some lowly shepherds. And during this time, Moses began to purge the palace from himself. Because you see, it is one thing to remove ourselves from the palace. It is an entirely different thing to remove the palace from within ourselves. It is a singular act to purge ourselves from the palace. It is a continuing act of self-reflection to purge the palace from ourselves. You see, the act to purge yourself from the palace, in that act, Moses recognized where his roots were. But he didn't rise yet. He didn't immediately go from killing the Egyptian slave master to liberating the Hebrew slaves. He didn't turn the page on that book and begin his work as an activist, if you will. No. Moses had to flee to Midian to spend time with the lowly people. And in so doing, began purging the palace from himself. Only after Moses had purged the palace from himself did he move out to the wilderness and encounter God. If Moses' spirit never remembers the songs of his mother and his grandmother, then Moses doesn't act. If he doesn't act, he doesn't flee. If he doesn't flee, he doesn't decolonize himself. And if he doesn't decolonize himself, he doesn't encounter God. And if he doesn't encounter God, there is no liberation. It all began. The entire story of Exodus begins with Moses recognizing where his roots are. Where those sacred songs of his mother and grandmothers are. It is a singular act to purge yourself from the palace. It's not hard to do. It's a little hard to do. But really, it's not that hard to do. The real work of liberation, the real work of freedom, is done not in the vocal, supreme act of purging yourself from the palace, but it is in the quiet, self-reflective work of purging the palace from us. When Moses purged the palace from himself, went out into the wilderness, encountered God. That is where he rose to become an agent of liberation. Many of us recognize the injustice inherent in the system, and we have done our best to purge ourselves from the past. Now begins the deep self-reflective work of where does the palace live in us? Where does the palace live in us? When we see valid points about conservative fear of undocumented immigration, perhaps the palace still lives in us. Because we don't want to freely give land and rights to undocumented people that are ours. Really? Ours? We don't want to give undocumented people, indigenous people, separated by a river, not a border, a river. A river is not a border, it's a river. When we don't want to give undocumented people access to land because they're separated by a river, access to our land, mm-hmm. Really? Mm-hmm. Maybe the palace isn't us. When we hear yet another incident of an unarmed black man getting shot in the streets at the hands of police officers, and our first reaction is to give the benefit of the doubt to the police officer, maybe the palace still lives in us a little bit.
Yep. It's an act of faith.
Maybe the palace still lives in us. When we fear an environment where there could be repercussions for powerful men falsely accused of sexual assault, and we don't fear the reality that women are routinely sexually assaulted, maybe the palace lives in us. And it is pervasive. It is insidious, and it is disgusting. I want to share with you what I posted on my Facebook page 2 weeks ago, about 2 weeks ago now. Yeah, on September 28th. After I listened to the testimony Dr. Ford, Brett Cavett. I'll just read it for you. A deeply personal story concerning why I believe her. There are those that look at Kavanaugh's behavior yesterday and see a man that is unjustly accused, passionately defending his character. My own experience leads me to believe something different. I was sexually abused by my stepfather. It began when I was 5 years old. It continued quite regularly until I revealed it to my mother when I was 11. He was charged and brought to trial. By all accounts, he was an upstanding man. He had a decent job, provided for our family well. He was a volunteer firefighter and a member in good standing at our church. All throughout the legal process, I felt believed and supported. I know that many, too many women that come forward are not. The trial took place in January. My birthday is January 12th. I was scheduled to testify on my birthday, my golden birthday. Thankfully, my testimony was postponed for one day, saving me from an unbelievable trauma on my birthday. Still, that birthday passed with very little celebration. I received a few presents from my mother and father in an empty jury deliberation room in the St. Paul courthouse. As we arrived at the courthouse the next day, an unbearable fear took over my body. I struggled to suppress the tears. I still remember the sickening nausea that settled in my stomach. I remember how my vision narrowed and my breathing fell labored. I remember that I wanted to be somewhere, dear God, anywhere, but in that courtroom. I remember the shame and embarrassment that washed over me as I had to, in front of strangers, reference the most intimate parts of my body. I remember the hateful, piercing stare and adamant head shaking from my abuser as I answered each and every question. I remember afterwards, as my mother and I were returning home, feeling as if every ounce of energy was draining from my body. I wanted to just fall asleep and never wake up. To this day, I cannot walk into the St. Paul courthouse without feeling a knot in my stomach. My abuser vehemently denied his accusations. He rigorously tried to defend his character. At first, he said that I had simply misunderstood some father-son innocent horseplay. Then he later accused me of lying about the whole thing and making everything up. He did this with emotional outbursts and loss of composure, both of which I witnessed in the hearing yesterday. What I saw in Dr. Ford was a victim experiencing the effects of PTSD, as she recalled a very real trauma. My abuser is now a free man. He has a new family and a house in a nice suburban neighborhood. I know where he lives. On rare occasions, my work brings me into that neighborhood. I go out of my way to avoid the street he lives on. My heart races, and the stomach knot returns as I play out the scenario in my head. What would happen if I came across him walking with his family while I was working in his neighborhood? I'm a grown man, and I live with that fear. So you may see the behaviors of Kavanaugh and see a man passionately defending his character with false accusations. I see a man that is deathly afraid of losing all of the privileges, comfort, and power that he has enjoyed for many years. I've stared into those eyes as a 12-year-old. I recognize it for what it is, not righteous anger, but uncontrollable fear. This is my story. I am a survivor, and I believe her. I posted this, and then, as one might expect, immediately I started receiving affirming words, comforting comments as people express their love and appreciation. What you might not expect is that I actually had to delete a couple of comments. Nothing openly hostile, but comments such as, "Jim Bear, that's a beautiful story, but you can't take your experience and broadcast that and generalize that upon every situation." Really, I have been working in anti-racism fields for the last decade of my life, and you're going to tell me about generalizing. I was getting mansplained. The two people who were mansplaining to me were women. They were expressing concerns of what would happen if their sons were falsely accused of sexual assault. Now, both of these women who were mansplaining to me also had. When we are more concerned about the 2% chance that your son will be falsely accused of sexual assault, when you're more concerned about that than the 48% reality that your daughter will be sexually assaulted, the palace is in you. When you take on a narrative, internalize it so much that when someone who comes along and even tries to speak to your liberation, you reaffirm the narrative, reaffirming your own oppression. The palace lives in you. As I said, my activism has a birth narrative. But I didn't emerge from that day, Columbus Day, sophomore year of high school, you know, a fully fledged social justice warrior. There was a maturing process because the palace still lived in me. I was fully concerned with Native rights. I was still leery of Black people, a little bit. I wanted justice for my Native brothers and sisters. I was still homophobic, part of it. I wanted liberation for my ancestors and for my descendants. I still believe thoughts over victims. What it took for me was to sit with those that society deems as lonely people. To sit with whom our society oppresses. Moses went to Midian and found his home among the lowly shepherds. And that is where he began to rise. That is where he began to rise. As I moved out of my comfortable suburban evangelical mega church existence, I began sitting with my African American relatives in neighborhoods that I had always been too afraid to go into. The palace started being stripped out of my body. As I sat down with queer identifying folks and recognized the beauty, the gift that is their life and their perspective, the palace started purging from my body. As I listened to stories of people who face the most brutal force at the hands of police, firsthand accounts, my spirit began recognizing something, and the palace began to be removed from my body. As I've said, maybe this sermon isn't for you, because if there's one thing I know about MWCC, it is that you are out front in causes for people's liberation. But still, maybe we're somewhere on a spectrum. And maybe we're not even aware that the palace can live in our bodies until someone comes along and says, the palace can live in your body. You may have removed yourself from the palace, but the palace may not be removed from you. Let's come together. Recognize our deep spiritual roots are not among the powerful, the privileged, the wealthy. Our deep spiritual